Back together, you and I, kicking off a brand new week, Monday, March 25th, 2024, on Connecticut Today. I started the show wondering out loud why EV drivers in the state continue to get away with not contributing to Connecticut's transportation fund. Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence, Dr. Gary Rose, dropped by to comment on the current news surrounding former President Donald Trump, while Connecticut News Junkie columnist and Substack.com blogger Terry Cowgill dropped by for his weekly check-in. You know, if you drive an EV, an electric vehicle, a straight electric vehicle, where you're buying no gasoline, no gas for a traditional internal combustion engine or ICE vehicle, and or a hybrid, which has a system that kind of runs partially on the battery in the car or the vehicle or the SUV, and or switching off at lower speeds and high speeds of the engine, whatever. I don't know the technical end of it. It is a marvel of technology. But if you drive right now an electric vehicle, again, not a hybrid, because with a hybrid you are paying some mound of a gasoline tax here and there, but if you're driving a straight EV, do you know you're constantly getting a tax break? And is that fair? Because there is the notion, and I kind of agree with this, if you are driving a straight electric vehicle, whether it's your primary vehicle, whether it's a sedan, an SUV, a truck, or whatever, you're getting a tax break and you need to have your taxes raised. And I've always thought this, and I was reinforced in this thinking. In a column I read actually yesterday, it came out over the weekend, one of our show contributors that I have here on the program, at least once a month or every month and a half or so, we had him on, I think, a few days ago, Jim Cameron, talking transportation. And he brings up an interesting point here, and I already have a Facebook question popped up here to get us going here on this new week. Hi, glad you're stopping by. Should Connecticut tax electric vehicles? EVs, Jim points out here quite properly, if you are driving an electric vehicle, you don't pay any gasoline taxes. So you're using the road free. You're getting a tax break every time you drive and don't use any gasoline if it's a straight electric vehicle, or even some gasoline if it's an EV. But I'm willing to give the EV people that have adopted the EVs or EV owners or drivers, you know what, you can have a break there because you are buying some gas. But if you're not buying any gasoline and you're using an electric vehicle, I think you need to have your taxes raised. Don't we always talk about fairness? As Jim points out here. Now, I went and did the math on what I tend to pay in gasoline taxes on a year. Now, I took out the old calculator, figured, knowing how my car performs, took a round figure. So I generally drive about 18,000 miles a year, right? About 18 grand for me on the high end of normal. You know, the feds and everybody, they say most Americans with full-time jobs, non-retirees, you're logging anywhere from 12 to 18,000 miles a year. The low end is 12 grand. The middle range is about 15,000 miles. And the high end's about 18,000 or so. Anything below or above that, you're not considered in the norm. So I did the math. I said, well, you know, 18,000 miles a year. And my car averages what they call the mixed loop. I average city and highway about 30 miles a gallon. Some weeks it's 28. Some weeks it's 32. So I end up buying, when I did the quick math here, I end up buying about 600 gallons of gasoline a year. And I looked up the Connecticut gas tax. Now, of course, there's a federal gas tax, too. But the Connecticut gas tax is 25 cents a gallon. So if I'm buying 600 gallons of gas a year, that's just me. Now, you could be different kind of vehicle, hybrid, straight gasoline or whatever. But for me, I'm buying 600, roughly 600, easy figure to calculate, 600 gallons of fuel a year at 25 cents a gallon. So me, little old me, driving a $18,000 sedan, not a high-performance vehicle, just getting back and forth, pretty reliable, I'm paying about $150 a year in gasoline tax, which now, because of all that controversy, I guess they're watching a little closer from the mess we had a few years ago when the money was being siphoned away and intercepted. So I'm contributing, because I drive an internal combustion engine vehicle, I am contributing $150 a year to the state transportation fund. What does $150 get me? I have no idea. Is it filling a pothole? Is it adding a little cement to a curb? Have I bought a portion of a sewer grate? Have I paid maybe one day's wages for somebody on a road crew on I-95 or I-91? I have no idea. But I do know that I can run the math. So me, little old me, use your buddy, your pal here, Paul Z, to have an example here. $150 a year, about. Now, if you drive an electric vehicle, you're not paying anything. Why should I have to pay, right? And you have to pay nothing. I have to pay something, and you get away, as our buddy Jim Cameron pointed out here, you largely get away with nothing, with paying nothing. Now, Jim writes here, the point is, this is him talking, not me, EV drivers should be paying for our roads just like everybody else. Why? Because EVs beat up our highways more than traditional internal combustion engine cars. EVs are super heavy. A Tesla Model X, Jim writes here, nice car, that's me saying it, not Jim. A Tesla Model X weighs over 5,000 pounds. The average American vehicle weighs 3,750 pounds. Heavier vehicles cause more damage to our roads than lighter ones and should pay accordingly. And on top of this, you know, Jim points out here in this piece, and I have posted it if you want to read it, on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WICC600, EV buyers get discounts as well. So a lot of EV buyers end up buying the EV because they get a tax credit. They get a $7,500 tax credit, which effectively lowers your purchase price. Many utility companies also give you a rebate for installing a home charging system. Now, if you took advantage of all this and you love your EV, and you got that break from, I don't know, whether it was UI or maybe Eversource and one of the smaller local electric conglomerates around the state to put in your charger, that's great. And if the state and the feds gave you this tax break to buy the vehicle, that's fine. But you still have to pay more. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Now, there are some states, a lot of them, almost three dozen of them, 30 or so, that require EVs to pay an upfront fee when, in fact, they are registered. And some states require yearly fees from EV owners because a lot of these states say, hey, this isn't fair. You're not paying any gas tax. Now, agree with me or not? I think it's fair. And I'm not trying to be a jerk here and turn the knife. No, listen, these are fine vehicles. But Jim brought up a great point here that I've always thought about, and I'm glad he wrote this. Why do people who buy EVs get a break from contributing to maintenance of the roads? They don't pay anything, which is another idiotic reason to keep pushing this EV mantra without asking people. I'm not saying Don't buy an EV. No, on the contrary, if you want one, fine. It's the American way. But shouldn't there be a yearly fee? I think Texas does this, or some other states. And they get a bill from the state, and I think it's $200 a year, $150 or $200 a year. Why shouldn't that be done here in Connecticut? And again, you know me, I'm not one for raising taxes. I think we tax far too many people on far too many things, far too often for a lot of, you know, reasons that are far too ridiculous. But nothing on an EV, and I'm paying ostensibly $150, $250 a year to maintain the roads. Seriously. And you're getting a break on your electricity. Now I have Wallingford Electric, so I get a break every month. But I think you know what I'm driving at here. So I have the, we'll get to the phones in a second. I have the question up here at Facebook.com, WICC600. Should Connecticut join the states charging EV owners registration and or yearly fees to make up for the lost gas tax revenue? I'm a couple of $100, $150. I don't think that's unfair to you. Let's kick it off this week with Rob in Seymour. Rob, hi, you're on WICC. What's up?
I heard you talking about the 25 cents gas tax.
Yeah.
That tax is only at the pump.
Yeah.
Our legislators also instituted an 8% gross tax.
Oh, I know.
On any petroleum.
Yeah, the gross receipts tax. So, yeah.
Yeah, the gross receipts. So you have to add another 24 cents to that mm-hmm. gallon of gas. So you're actually paying 50 cents a gallon of gas.
All right, so all the more, Rob, all the more it makes me mad. Why am I getting away with $300 a year to pay and EV owners aren't paying anything? Explain to me how that makes sense. Go ahead.
It doesn't, especially when the cars are heavier and have more wear and tear on the roads.
Yeah, yeah. Rob, thank you. Appreciate it there, Rob and Seymour. See, Rob agrees with me. He doesn't think I'm an idiot. See, I like Rob. Rob is good people. So however you figure the tax, and Rob is right, there's a gross receipts tax on top of that. And also, if you want to count it, it doesn't go to Connecticut, but you got the federal tax too. Here's the bottom line. Is it fair? Simple question. Is it fair that owners of straight electric vehicles, not talking about hybrids, because hybrids use some sort of gasoline, which is fine as it hands off between the gas engine and the electric motors, but how is it that EV owners get to drive around on the roads and not pay anything to maintain them? All right, we'll talk a little politics now. Standing by is one of our go-to guys on this, of course, Dr. Gary Rose. He's been with us numerous times, Sacred Heart University political science professor and scholar in residence. We're going to get to Gary momentarily. I want to play this, though, and get his feelings on it. This clip made the rounds on social media like crazy over the weekend. It is an appearance on CNN. Runs about a minute. I want to have you folks listen to it. It's an appearance on CNN by Frank Luntz, who I think is a Connecticut native. Anyway, Frank is kind of like the emeritus or the preeminent Republican pollster. He doesn't get it right all the time. No pollster does. But he made a very specific warning a couple of days ago on CNN. He was part of a panel. And they were talking about this push that a lot of people want to see to rebrand or brand Donald Trump as broke. It's coming from the corporate Democrats in Washington. And these are people who want to see, you know, Trump Tower seized. They want to see his Mar-a-Lago estate seized. They want to see his golf course in Bedminster, New Jersey seized. In other words, they want to publicly embarrass him. And Frank Luntz took a deep breath on CNN and basically said for about 3 minutes, I'll give you about half of this, he basically said, don't do it.
All right, Frank. The politics of this. Folks in the Biden campaign are already starting to refer to Donald Trump as broke Don, which is interesting. And then there is the possibility that the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, would have to start or would start seizing assets, maybe even buildings. How do you think that would play?
I want you to remember this moment and don't forget it. If the New York Attorney General starts to take his homes away, starts to seize his assets. It's all going to be on camera. Pundits are going to sit there and scream about this. This man cannot be elected. You're going to create the greatest victimhood of 2024, and you're going to elect Donald Trump. If they take his stuff, he's going to say that this is proof that the federal government and the establishment and the swamp in Washington and all the politicians across the country and the attorneys generals and all of this, that this is a conspiracy to deny him the presidency. He's going to go up in the polls just like he went up every single time they indicted him. The indictment, let's not talk about whether it's justified or not, but it will prove the things that he's saying on the campaign trail, and he will go up, and it may just elect him president. Do not forget that. And I say this to the attorney general right now. If you play politics on this, this is what the secretaries of state did in Colorado and what they did in, I believe, was Maine. His numbers went up in both states. I don't understand. I'm almost speechless in how pathetic the opposition to Trump has been and how completely misguided. And this is a perfect example of it.
All right. What do we think of that? Bring in Dr. Gary Rose. Gary, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. How are you?
What do you make of that, Gary? Any truth to what you think Frank Luntz said there or not?
Well, you know, I saw Frank say that on television.
Okay, yeah.
And, yeah, I'm very aware of it. And, yeah, there is an element of truth to that, particularly, however, among Republican voters who it's probably Republicans on the fence,
mm-hmm.
I think, would probably certainly feel that, you know, that's really uncalled for and you know, it's persecution. And so they probably will vote for Trump. But I question, you know, Frank's larger statement that this is going to end up in an election for
mm-hmm.
Trump, because I'm not actually certain that unaffiliated voters and those who voted for Nikki and, you know, who are in the independent column will gravitate to him if his property is seized. So I think it'll strengthen certainly some moderate Republicans, but I think that's about as far as it goes. And I'm not certain that, even though I think that seizing his property is certainly illegal. I think it's illegal, but nevertheless, I don't think that that's necessarily the election's necessarily hinging on what Letitia James does and so forth. So
he got a bit of a break today, I guess, Gary, where he doesn't have to come up with all 400 and however million dollars. They're giving him a few days to come up with 170 or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that. I guess he did get a break on that, and they've cut it down, you know, substantially. And apparently he has that in cash, at least that's what he says. And so I think that he does have a break that he's going to be able to also, you know, appeal this unbelievable ruling that came down. So, yeah, I'd say that he definitely won one today with that ruling.
The polls, and the guest is Dr. Gary Rose, of course, scholar in residence at Sacred Heart University. Gary, the polls don't seem to be moving, and I still know it's relatively early. We're not into April yet, but, you know, the polls are not really moving. And I keep telling people, Gary, as you probably tell your classes, forget 43 states. It's a 7-state race, and he still has leads in about 4 or 5 of those states that are outside the margin of error. I don't know. I know it's early, but I would have thought, and I've said it, Gary, on this program, I would have thought you would have seen some more significant movement yet. Am I wrong here? Do you think it's still too far out? Because I find it odd, and I know you and I do this for a living, but I'd be amazed that there aren't people, quote-unquote, paying attention yet. I don't know if I buy that. No, I mean, seriously, how are people not paying it? Did they just land from Venus? I mean, how are they, you know, how do they not know what's going on here?
Yeah, that's a good question. It really is. Yeah, no, back to your original question, though, it is true that it's coming down to a very small handful of states. You said around 7 or so. Some say 9, some say 11, 12. You know, yeah, I know. I mean, we've become a very red and blue country, And we have states that are deep red, deep blue, and so incredibly predictable now, and one of which is, of course, the state of Connecticut. And you're right, the polls are pretty much locked in right now, and it looks very, very close. And I think in the end, you know, it's going to be those handful of states that we're talking about that will make the difference. And there, something, Paul, that's something I've been saying, too. I know it didn't come up in your question, but I do believe that, you know, candidates like RFK Jr., a third-party candidate in those swing states could make a major difference in the outcome of this forthcoming contest. I do believe that this time we're going to see a very real possibility that a third-party candidate swings the election.
Yeah, and Gary, it's not like he's down around 2 or 3% with Dr. Cornel West and Jill Stein. I mean, Gary, all the polling I see, he's got 9, 10, 18, 15%. I mean, it's almost like some of the Democrats are like, la, 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 like, they don't want to. But you look at the numbers, Gary, unless people are lying or unless they'll change and not be so enamored by the Kennedy name. But this, he's got some real sizable relatively vote numbers in some of these states.
Well, he really does. And I know, you know, we always say that, you know, individuals who say they're going to vote for a third party come home in the end. And it is true that the pattern, you know, suggests that over time. But in this particular election, we've never had two candidates who are less respected than both, Donald Trump and President Biden. And so I think there's a real possibility that a lot of voters, a lot of them, I think, are going to stay home, quite frankly.
Really?
But those that do go to the polls, I will not at all be surprised if RFK Jr. in particular, not Cornel West, and, you know, although, you know, Jill Stein could do well, like in Michigan, like she did last time, and I don't foresee a no labels candidate on the horizon, although there's been talk of that. But nevertheless, back to RFK Jr., I think he could really be the deal breaker this time, because I don't think a lot of these people that are saying that they're going to vote for him are going to come home as they've done in the past with third party candidates because of their dislike and distrust and of, you know, the nominees of the two parties. I've never seen it. I've never seen the distrust of the two nominees this high ever, and dislike.
Yeah, and a couple of more things, Gary, here. Number one, you're really starting to see articles, and I know you and I read about the same thing. There is real panic among the Democrats, Gary, of a back-breaking low turnout of African-American and especially Hispanic voters. And, you know, Gary, politicians and pundits and folks like you and people I've talked to over the years, they've always, you know, alluded to a point where maybe they thought the Hispanic vote would not completely turn, but there'd be a wave. You know, I wonder if we're seeing it here, because I'm reading all these stories where the Dems are now openly panicking about this. They're not whispering about this anymore.
Well, they should be panicking, because it is true that not so much among the African-American vote, but the Hispanic vote is very much in transition in this country. And black males are moving somewhat, but black females are not. But nevertheless, among Hispanics, males and females, we find more and more of them leaning Republican these days. And if I was a Democratic consultant, I would be very concerned about that, because the Hispanic vote is really one of the largest ethnic groups now, you know, minority groups in the country, and they can make a major difference in some of those states that we're talking about, the swing states. So, yeah, that's a vote that's clearly, can't say it's fully realigned yet, but it certainly is moving in a Republican direction and has been for the last couple of election cycles.
The U.S. earlier today did not stand in the way, Gary, of a U.N. resolution pushing for a ceasefire now on both sides, Israel versus Hamas. Interesting. You wonder, Gary, at least I did openly, how much of this is a fear of, say, losing Michigan and maybe another couple of other states because of the far left of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I know. The pro-Palestinian, I can't say necessarily pro-Hamas, but the pro-Palestinian dimension of the Democratic Party is very real now, very strong. And there has been you know, somewhat of a anti-Semitic dimension now showing up in that party. And so, you know, what goes on in Israel could actually, we talked about RFK Jr., mm-hmm. but what goes on there and American foreign policy on that issue could also swing this election. Now, the question is, where do pro-Palestinian Democrats go?
Yeah.
And they don't go to Donald Trump. They don't go to Biden. They could potentially go to a third-party candidate.
And finally, Gary, before I picked up the phone here a couple of seconds ago to talk with you, I looked up at my TV monitor and I saw a picture of Mike Johnson, the Republican House Speaker, who looked like about the most miserable guy on the planet in the last hour. Good Lord, why would anybody, Gary, want to be a Republican House Speaker right now, especially dealing with Ms. Green? Oh, my God.
I know, isn't that? I know. I don't think he's going to lose his speakership, but it is interesting. You know, here we have a Republican Speaker, and he's going to depend completely on Democratic support to get anything done. And we really now have bipartisanship, if you want to call it that, going on in Congress. He certainly cannot depend on the Republicans to, you know, to carry his positions. He has to reach across the aisle now in order to get the majority there of the House. And so, yes, I know Marjorie Taylor Greene is calling for his removal, but I don't think that the votes are there to do that. And certainly the Democrats said they're not going to, go against him either. So he actually has a coalition right now, I think, to maintain his power. And I know it's really the Freedom Caucus is so adamant about, you know, just so ideological and so pure on issues, no willing to see any, you know, type of compromise as valuable. And that's really unfortunate.
And that's okay, Gary, right? When you have the numbers. This guy doesn't have the numbers. What's he supposed to do, right?
I know. That's right. The only way that he can govern is to hold together, you know, moderate Republicans and then reach across the aisle. And then he can get his majority, as they did with the budget vote there, the $1.3 trillion there. And so, I know it's difficult to be a speaker, but you know, even if they did remove him, the next speaker would be right in the same situation.
Where's Newt Gingrich? Where's Newt Gingrich? He's waiting in the wings. All right.
Yeah, I know.
Dr. Gary Rose, Gary, thanks. Always good to chat with you. We'll chat next month, sir. Thank you.
Okay, Paul. Good to hear from
you. Appreciate it. Dr. Gary Rose, Sacred Heart University. All right. Every Monday at about this time, we talk to a guy who writes nationally, writes locally for the Connecticut News Junkie, an observer of all things Connecticut. Terry Cowgill is with us. Mr. Cowgill, good afternoon, sir. And how are you?
Not too bad. I'm still reeling from what's happening on cable news. I'm trying to get over it.
Yeah, and I also want to talk about the issue with the Independent Party, because my head exploded on that last week, and I know yours is too. Terry, I got to tell you something. You've been on this show enough times to know, and you've read my social media posts. I love chaos. I love Terry. You know me by now. I do a show like this. I'm free and easy with my opinions on Facebook and other. I love when people's heads explode. In unison, maybe different people explode at different times. It can be like, the Boston Pops on the Esplanade there, you know, with John Williams. But yes, you're referring to, you just put a great piece up on Substack. Apparently, the powers that be at MSNBC, including Joe Scarborough and the missus, not too thrilled that NBC put a contract in front of Ronna McDaniel, the former RNC chair, and shocking, Terry, the dollar figure with it made her sign it. I'm completely shocked.
And to be clear, I hope this I made this clear in the piece. I'm against this practice of hiring these political hacks to come on and be commentators on news networks in the first place. And this is just one example. I think this is a particularly egregious example, but they do happen. McDaniel did a lot of things. By the way, she is Mitt Romney's niece, to make that clear, unless she got rid of Romney as her middle name, and I'll just go by Ron McDaniel. Not sure what to make of that. But, yeah, I mean, you know, she has said some nice things about the January 6th rioters, called them hostages and all this stuff. So that made people's head explode. She even said that the January 6th mob was engaged in what she called legitimate political discourse. And it just it goes on and on. But I think the worst thing she did was she got Donald Trump on the phone and they called officials in Detroit and tried to get them not to certify the county's presidential election results. That is a coercive measure. And so I can see how people at NBC didn't like this. Yeah. And there's nothing more delicious to me than seeing an open revolt at a major media outlet. I mean, talk about making your head explode, right?
But yeah, but you know what, Terry? Honestly, so if I'm part of the, you know, Kristen Welker and Chuck Todd and everybody, and I say, well, okay, let's get her on here, and I assume this is going to happen, Terry, if it hasn't happened already, and say, Ronna, great to have you on board. What in the hell were you thinking? Look in that camera and explain yourself. That's what I would do. That's just me, but that's probably going to be some, what do they used to say, Terry, must-see TV? Was that Thursday nights on NBC? I'm not sure. This could be interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, she actually was a guest on Meet the Press on Sunday.
Okay.
And Kristen Welker didn't know anything about it until Thursday when they sprung this news on her. And then the remarkable thing I thought about the whole thing, so she, Welker did interview McDaniel and pressed her on a lot of the things mm-hmm. that I just told you about.
Yeah, yeah.
But the most astonishing thing was that during the panel segment, Chuck Todd, who was Welker's immediate predecessor as host of Meet the Press, he got on and he said, I think the network owes you an apology. And he went on this, you know, 5-minute lecture about how irresponsible it was for the network to put her on. I've never seen anything like this in my life. And a lot of people were saying on Twitter, oh, well, you know, Todd is going to get fired over this.
No, he's not.
No, he's a pretty cautious guy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure he gauged the reaction among his colleagues at NBC, and he saw some safety in numbers, and he doesn't think he's going to get fired. But it was astonishing. I'd never seen really anything like it, and I would wager to say I probably won't see anything like it again.
Yeah, and you wonder, you know, and listen, I've done a little bit of TV in my life, and you wonder, Terry, if after this is done, you know, and the floor director says clear and everybody takes out their IFBs and takes off their mics, well, they all don't kind of just look at each other and smile and laugh and listen. You know, Terry, as well as I do, it's all about ratings, ratings and ad sales. And as much, Terry, and you and I know this, as MSNBC seethes and as CNN seethes about Donald Trump, he's driving so many hundreds of millions of dollars of ad revenue. It's amazing. Maybe it's not, but to me it is.
Yeah, he's been very good for the media business. I mean, there's absolutely no question about that. I've written that several times. And so he's kind of like, you know, he's the guy that a lot of these people love to hate. you know, some of them have to be secretly rooting for him to win.
Oh, my God.
Again,
yes.
It'll be the gift that keeps on giving. And every day it'll be constant drama. It'll mean better ratings for all the cable news shows and probably a better hit for a lot of the political websites like Politico and others.
You also said you wanted to talk about something else. And, Terry, this broke, I think, last week after we had spoken. Look, I know a lot of people called me up and said, hey, maybe it's not such. But all of a sudden, Terry, isn't it amazing that there's confusion claimed after the party's been around since the mid-early 2000s. We have this assertion of mass confusion from voters saying, hey, maybe we got to get rid of that independent party line in Connecticut, which I'm sure Terry Cowgill had nothing to do with the fact that John Gomes ran on the independent party line, but it's all about confusion. Terry, look, I could be wrong. I'm just saying this. My show, I told people this. This to me looks like an old-fashioned kneecapping here. Those are my words, not yours.
Yeah. I think, as somebody who's never belonged to a political party and has been an independent for, ever since I registered to vote in 1976, I believe it was, this really bothered me. And it's one of the reasons that I didn't want to talk about it. And first of all, they buried this in a larger bill. Right. So,
yeah,
this is what I think. The Democratic State Representative Jack Hennessey from Bridgeport, and to your comment about the Bridgeport election, he called this clause in the larger bill about election security illegal, undemocratic, and he used the term a rat. And that seems to be uniquely Connecticut. And it basically, it's a little unpleasant thing that they incorporate into a larger bill, and they hope nobody will notice it. And fortunately, they did notice it. But no, this is all about the two-party duopoly. And they don't like the fact that people look at the independent party. A lot of people consider themselves to be independent-minded. So they look at the independent party and they go, oh, that's great. I want to belong to that party. And Democrats and Republicans just don't like this because they like everything to fit neatly into two boxes. And when it doesn't work, they always find an excuse to try to change things if they can. I have a feeling that this is not going to make it at the end. I certainly hope that it gets stricken from the legislation.
And Terry, from that Hearst story, you and I obviously read the same stories. I think they went to a Fairfield County elected official or somebody involved with the party who said, and she said quite rightly, and I tried to echo that here on the program, you know, let's not say this is confusing. She claims they call themselves the independent party because A, they want to be a party, but B, they want to be independent of the Democrats and the Republicans. So she's saying, yeah, look, we can be a party, but be independent of the two juggernauts. And I agree with her. Stop trying to tell me, well, it should be, you know, people get confused with unaffiliated and unattached. Well, Terry, with all due respect to those people, they got to read a little closer. So what this woman said, I agree with 100% wholeheartedly.
Yeah, and I think it's part of a larger problem, which is that Connecticut is one of the most partisan states in the nation, because not only are municipal elections partisan, but school board elections are too. There's only four states in the country that have partisan school board elections, and Connecticut is one of them, Rhode Island, Pennsylvania, and I think Louisiana, and that's it. But people love the party identifications here in Connecticut. Of course, unaffiliateds may not vote in primaries. It's very restricted. It's very clubby, and they want everybody to belong to one of those two clubs. And if you don't, well, you're going to be at a disadvantage. You won't have ballot access if you're a candidate, unless you jump through hoops. We really need reform in this state in terms of elections, not only election integrity, but also just in terms of ballot access and the way we think about party affiliation.
And Terry, finally, I know, and you kind of triggered me here a little bit in a good way with the Board of Ed elections. I've said for years, Terry, I don't know how you feel about this, but I know there are some people that call me and tell me they agree. You know, Terry, I think we should mirror the federal government more. Okay, vote for a governor, vote for a lieutenant governor, but I despise voting for the constitutional offices. I don't think there should be anything political, although inherently there is. I don't think people should vote for an attorney general or a secretary of the state or a treasurer. I think it should be like the federal government. This is just me. Okay, this governor and this lieutenant governor won. Okay, here are my cabinet picks. Let's do this like the feds do, and they sit down for hearings. I've never understood, for example, why the attorney general of the state of Connecticut, the top civil law enforcement officer, is political. I don't get that.
Well, actually, I mean, since the attorney general in Connecticut doesn't prosecute criminal cases, and basically it is a political position.
Yeah.
They just go around suing everybody.
Yeah.
So I don't have a problem with that, I suppose. But in general, yeah, I do agree with you. A lot of these positions do not necessarily lend themselves to getting elected, and they don't necessarily attract the right candidates. I'd rather have professionals in there. And, you know, if you elect a governor, let them implement their
yes.
vision with their own cabinet. I think that's fair in general, yeah.
See, Terry, if you and I team up for the next 4 or 8 years, we've got all the answers. I like that. How about that? You take the top spot. I'll be the lieutenant governor, and I'll go to all the ribbon cuttings. Deal? Does that work?
Oh, yeah. You can do your best imitation of Jody Rell. She went to ribbon cuttings even when she became governor. She couldn't get out of lieutenant governor mode.
Terry Cowgill, Connecticut News Junkie, ctnewsjunkie.com, and also substack.com. The blog is Red Meat for Mushy Moderates. Terry, thank you. We appreciate it. Have a great week. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, man.
All right. Very good, my friend. Thank you.
Thanks. All right.